this time of campaign speeches, Black History Month, and the start of President Obama's final year in office, New Letters on the Air revisits a conversation with Kai Wright, who in March 2016 becomes the features editor for The Nation, the weekly magazine that started in 1865. Wright discusses his 2009 anthology, The African American Experience, Black History and Culture through speeches, letters, editorials, poems, songs, and stories. We'll hear about the oratory of Frederick Douglass, Martin Luther King, and President Barack Obama, and the influence of history.
You're a fool if you seek to write in a vacuum, if you're not trying to hear other voices and learn from them and have them push you in one direction or another and inform you. That's just silliness.
Kai Wright and his anthology, The African American Experience, that examines the influence of recorded words from 16th century America to Barack Obama's campaign speeches on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Wright introduces his 700-page anthology with a short history of the Black man on this continent and traces the four centuries through documents going back to a log about slaves of the earliest Spanish conquerors. I was curious about the impetus for this all-encompassing collection.
The overarching idea is to really make this history much more approachable and usable across a big span of time outside of the academy. You know, I'm a journalist, not a historian. And I was in a conversation with the publisher, Black Dog and Leventhal, and I'll say it, you know, it was their idea. They had done similar archives, I believe, of the Civil War, and they had done more specific time periods. And we sort of talked it through and came up with this idea of a whole breadth, going back as far back as we could identify something called an African American, and trying to tell history in the words of the people who lived it. So I spent, a little over a year hanging out in the Library of Congress, which is a wonderful thing to do. If anyone ever has an opportunity, that's a great way to spend time. And just going through all of these documents and learning so much myself in the process and figuring out how to tell history in first person. It was rewarding for me, and so I'm glad to hear that it comes through in the collection as well. We want to, again, move the conversation out of the academic circles where history so often lives and get it into a popular conversation. And so that was the idea with the collection.
Yeah, I think it works beautifully. Well, you spent a year in the Library of Congress researching this. Was this your full-time job at that point, or were you doing other things? I know you're a writer. You write journalistic pieces. So tell me a little bit of your life during that year.
Well, sadly, no, it wasn't my full-time job. Life as a freelance writer is always a hustle. And so you do many, many things to keep the lights on while you pursue these big ideas. I write a lot about race and the politics thereof, so there is some redundancy. And one of the neat things about the collection is that I use it so often in my work because I write about race politics and I like to bring history into the current conversation. I'm always digging the book back off the shelf, digging my notes back out, trying to find just that right voice from history to inform what we're talking about now. I just finished a column about Barack Obama's styling himself as Abe Lincoln down to the inaugural Bible, and I've found myself going back over some of Frederick Douglass's ideas and speeches and writings from the archive to help us understand a different side of that history, not just Lincoln, but the opposition to Lincoln and what that might mean for Barack Obama. When I was putting it together, it required juggling many things at once, but the fruits of the labor is that now I can use it to juggle many things at once.
It's interesting that you should mention Frederick Douglass, because I thought it might be kind of interesting to visit some of the speeches that have been made in our history. And the first one I thought I would start with was Frederick Douglass. Remind people who Frederick Douglass is. Everybody should know who he is, but just in case.
Well, everyone should, but alas, may not. And that's one of the things that we hope something like this book can do, is bring everybody from Douglass, who is well-known, to less well-known voices into the current time. Douglass was one of the first national celebrities as an African-American political orator, having escaped slavery himself and linked up with the abolitionist movement at its onset. He became one of the escaped slaves that they would take around to meetings to say the abolitionists would speak, and it would be white person speaking to white person, and then they would turn to the ex-slave and say, now tell us of your experience. And they would tell him exactly what to say, and at first he thought that was okay, but eventually he started to chafe against it. He said, you know, I've got some things to say on my own. I don't really care what it is you want me to say. And so he started developing his own oratorical style, and it was quite popular on the lecture circuit.
I was wondering if you might want to read one of those passages for us today. And I was thinking specifically of the end of What is American Slavery? And maybe setting this up, he's giving this speech in England.
He published a narrative of his slave experience in which he outed himself as an escaped slave and named his purported owner. And that, of course, opened him up to recapture. So he fled the country for a while and continued his abolition advocacy overseas in England. And this speech is one of the more well-known that he gave there, where he's describing slavery as for what it is. It's important to remember that at the time, there were all of these excuses for slavery, of course. People were able to sort of think of the institution as something that was more genteel than it was, or people were able to think of the institution absent from many of its realities, because many people had not been into the southern United States, had not seen this slavery up close and personal. And so part of his oratory power was that he would describe it as the really base thing that it was.
And you have one of his earlier speeches in this book as well, where he really does give a description of some of the atrocities of slavery. But this piece is a little bit later on.
Yes. And you'll excuse my non-professional reading. My exposure of slavery abroad will tell more upon the hearts and consciences of slaveholders than if I was attacking them in America. For almost every paper that I now receive from the United States comes teeming with statements about this fugitive Negro, calling him a glib-tongued scoundrel, and saying that he is running out against the institutions and people of America. I deny the charge that I am saying a word against the institutions of America, or the people as such. What I have to say is against slavery and slaveholders. I feel at liberty to speak on this subject. I have on my back the marks of the lash. I have four sisters and one brother now under the galling chain. I feel it my duty to cry aloud and spare not. I am not averse to having the good opinion of my fellow creatures. I am not averse to being kindly regarded by all men. But I am bound, even at the hazard of making a large class of religionists in this country hate me, oppose me, and malign me as they have done, I am bound by the prayers and tears and entreaties of 3 millions of kneeling bondsmen to have no compromise with men who are in any shape or form connected with the slaveholders of America. I expose slavery in this country because to expose it is to kill it. Slavery is one of those monsters of darkness to whom the light of truth is death. Expose slavery, and it dies. Light is to slavery what the heat of the sun is to the root of a tree. It must die under it. All the slaveholder asks of me is silence. He does not ask me to go abroad and preach in favor of slavery. He does not ask anyone to do that. He would not say that slavery is a good thing, but the best under the circumstances. The slaveholders want total darkness on the subject. They want the hatchway shut down, that the monster may crawl in his den of darkness, crushing human hopes and happiness, destroying the bondman at will, and having no one to reprove or rebuke him. Slavery shrinks from the light. It hateth the light. Neither cometh to the light, lest its deeds should be reproved. To tear off the mask from this abominable system, to expose it to the light of heaven, aye, to the heat of the sun, that it may burn and wither it out of existence, is my object in coming to this country. I want the slaveholder surrounded, as by a wall of anti-slavery fire, so that he may see the condemnation of himself and his system glaring down in letters of light. I want him to feel that he has no sympathy in England, Scotland, or Ireland, that he has none in Canada, none in Mexico, none among the poor wild Indians, that the voice of the civilized eye and savage world is against him. I would have condemnation blaze down upon him in every direction till, stunned and overwhelmed with shame and confusion, he is compelled to let go the grasp he holds upon the persons of his victims and restore them to their long-lost rights.
That's from What is American Slavery by Frederick Douglass, which is included in the collection The African American Experience, Black History and Culture through Speeches, Letters, Editorials, Poems, Songs, and Stories, and edited by Kai Wright, who read that for us today on New Letters on the Air.
And so he would grow fiery, as you can see, in his refusal to be silent about slavery. And that is a much more radical notion now than we can remember, sadly, that so much of the power that allowed slavery to continue was in silence about it, was in ignorance about it, was in the lies that everyone would agree to believe in about its humanity.
You know, the silence about it, it came up again in the civil rights movement with Martin Luther King, which, you know, comes out in some of his speeches as well. Before we leave Frederick Douglass, I've got to say that one of the things that's really powerful about this collection that you've put together is the way you've sandwiched things. What follows Frederick Douglass, there are several passages that have to do with things that he's written or spoken, and we have Sojourner Truth, Aren't I a Woman? Mm-hmm. And that is just such powerful, powerful language and ideas. And the important thing to note, too, is that Frederick Douglass wasn't just against slavery, but he was also for women's rights.
One of the things that got the abolitionists in so much trouble with the rest of the world was their willingness to let women be involved. And that was insanity that they were asking for. But we do try in the book to create a narrative. It's not something that you can read cover to cover, certainly. But I tried to arrange the documents in such a way that there is a narrative arc, because there is a narrative arc that is quite compelling to the course of Black history. And it's really fun to follow that arc again through the voices that lived it.
You know, you were just mentioning about the silence that people would fall into, and I was thinking about how Martin Luther King talks about that in one of the passages that you included in this. And this one was the letter from the Birmingham jail. And he talks, you know, about how he was confronted with a letter from a white brother in Texas who wrote, "All Christians know that the colored people will receive equal rights eventually, but it is possible that you are in too great a religious hurry. It has taken Christianity almost 2,000 years to accomplish what it has. The teachings of Christ take time to come to earth."
And I think it is important to remember, much like Douglass and slavery during the civil rights movement, the idea that you're asking for too much too fast was a very important justification for the existence of Jim Crow. That for even whites who said, okay, I get it, this is a brutal arrangement we've made in society, but we can't do too much too fast. We can't upset the carts. And that's something that we still hear in many reform movements today. And so King spent a lot of his time in his public conversation answering that notion. And in the letter from Birmingham jail is when he answers it most famously.
Martin Luther King writes back what his response to that is. And I wondered if you might want to read that.
"Such an attitude stems from a tragic misconception of time, from the strangely rational notion that there is something in the very flow of time that will inevitably cure all ills. Actually, time itself is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively. More and more, I feel that the people of ill will have used time much more effectively than have the people of goodwill. We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the hateful words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. Human progress never rolls in on wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts of men willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the forces of social stagnation. We must use time creatively, in the knowledge that the time is always ripe to do right. Now is the time to make real the promise of democracy and transform our pending national elegy into a creative psalm of brotherhood. Now is the time to lift our national policy from the quicksand of racial injustice to the solid rock of human dignity."
Those are the words of Martin Luther King Jr. from his letter from a Birmingham jail. And that's also in the African American Experience, the anthology gathered together by Kai Wright, who is with us today on New Letters on the Air. I thought how wonderful that is and how it sort of points to Obama recognizing that theme and what he had to talk about.
Certainly his message of change. One of the neat things about Barack Obama is that, you know, so much of the political oratory and the political perspective that has typified African-American reform movements from the outside are now the voice of the White House. His campaign speeches echo those of Douglas and King in many ways. One of the things that they all share is this taking America's feeling of exceptionalism as a place that has unique embrace of plurality, where anything is possible, and turning it on its head to throw it back in oppression's face. So Douglas was a firm believer that while there were some who said the Constitution is a meaningless document, that America is a depraved place, Douglas said, oh no, the Constitution is our tool to liberation. The American ideals are correct. The American exceptionalism is a correct idea. It's just not real. And we have to force it to be real. King did the same thing, where he would say, we're marching in these streets today because we're Americans. And so he would throw the American exceptionalism back in the face of oppression and say, this is why I'm here today, is because America's exceptional. Barack Obama did the same thing throughout his campaign and would say, we have to have change because America's an exceptional place.
One of the things we haven't touched on, and Martin Luther King is such a good writer and speaker about this, is the beauty and the poetry in some of the language that's used in these speeches. First of all, I have something to ask of you. Do you know how much of his speeches, I know he wrote them out because there are those famous copies of his handwritten speeches, but since you've studied all this, how much did he vary from what he wrote and then what he did when he stood up in front of people?
Well, like most great orators, he had some stump passages, right? And I believe the dream passage actually is one of them. And he would sort of mix and match them as needed. He would have the central point he was making on a given day or in a given text. And then as he got to his crescendo, he would read the crowd and pick from one of his stumps to riff on. And that was common practice. Though you have to say, I mean, he got his start at the Montgomery bus boycott with his nightly sermons, holding together the folks and reaffirming their ability to stay off the buses every day. And the first evening he had to give a sermon on this, and it's one of his most remarkable texts, and he wrote it in 30 minutes before he delivered it. So there, he was a brilliant mind, clearly, and had tools that he could pull from, but he was constantly creating in real time. That much seems obvious.
Yeah, that's King's December 5th, 1955 speech launching the prolonged boycott. I thought I would play a little bit of one of Martin Luther King's speeches, and that's such a beautiful speech, and it has the poetry that I was talking about because he has a bit of that repetition and that beautiful phrasing that he was able to put together. As you know, my friends, there comes a time when people get tired of being trampled.
You know, my friends, there comes a time when people get tired of being trampled over by the iron feet of oppression. And, my friend, when people get tired of being crammed to cramp the abyss of humiliation by their experience of bleakness and nagging despair, there comes a time when people get tired of being pushed out of the glittering sunlight of last July, left standing amid the piercing chill of an alpine November.
There comes a time. I mean, just that repetition that he has and that recognizing rhythm. He was brilliant in that way.
His speeches are beautifully composed texts, even without his delivery. Just the texts themselves are so beautiful.
They really are. So it's nice to have them together. You know, you can't help but think, too, of Barack Obama's incantation, "Yes, we can," being repeated. I think it was Toni Morrison who said that Barack Obama will probably be our most literate president. He really has a love of literature. He's been spotted carrying books of poetry, and he's obviously a vast reader. And so I'm sure that adds a lot to his power of putting together wonderful speeches.
All right. And a brilliant writer. Beyond his speeches, Dreams from My Father is beyond the ideas in it. It's a beautifully written book.
One of the things that you do before all of these different passages, and we're looking at a book that is over 700 pages long, but before each of the things that you include in here, you write a little piece and place it in history and what it says. And I thought I would get you to read a little piece of your own writing, introduction to "This Was the Moment Where America Remembered What It Means to Hope," by Barack Obama, and then you wrote a bit. Would you mind reading that for us today?
Barack Obama strode onto the national scene with electrifying performance at the Democratic National Convention during the hotly contested 2004 elections, where he introduced the nation to his compelling articulation of hope as a revolutionary act rather than a naive leap of faith. Democratic candidate John Kerry lost that election to President Bush, but Obama emerged from the campaign with the winds of history at his back. 2 years later, when he won the Illinois Senate seat in his first statewide campaign, speculation about his bright future erupted. Commentators of all political stripes mused improbably about Obama one day rising to become America's first black president. But going into the 2008 elections, no one considered that more than wistful punditry. Hillary Clinton was the Democrats' presumed nominee, and the neophyte Obama was surely going to wait his turn before trying something so audacious. But Obama proved to have more audacity than anyone could have imagined. The 48-year-old son of a white mother and black Kenyan father had already lived an unexpected life, having called places ranging from Hawaii to Harvard to the south side of Chicago his home. And he saw something in American political culture that few fully appreciated at the start of 2007. Voters were desperately seeking a dramatic break with the past, with a disastrous war dragging on and middle-class families increasingly pinched by everything from a housing market crisis to skyrocketing gas prices. A candidate that looked and sounded nothing like those they'd seen before held tremendous appeal. Obama stepped in to meet that demand. He announced his run in February 2007 and plunged into the longest primary season America had ever seen. The first actual vote wasn't until almost a year later, on January 3, 2008, in the Iowa Democratic Caucus. There, Obama stunned the nation with a commanding victory and immediately became the party's frontrunner for president. His victory speech from Des Moines was a hair-raising political moment in which black oratory, so long the impassioned and eloquent voice of an oppositional, marginalized minority, spoke for the political majority. Obama articulated the core message of his campaign: against all odds, America has the power to change, to become greater than the sum of its two long divided parts. He was the ideal carrier for such a message. Mixed racial heritage, old enough to be a baby boomer yet young enough to connect with those born into a post-Jim Crow world. Harvard educated, but having spent 20 years in community organizing. His very existence spanned multiple historic lines of division in American culture, and Democratic voters embraced it.
That's also in the African American Experience, the anthology gathered together by Kai Wright, who is with us today on New Letters on the Air. I thought that was a great introduction to this Iowa speech that he gave. And what a speech. It points up so much about hope.
Hope is what led a band of colonists to rise up against an empire, what led the greatest of generations to free a continent and heal a nation, what led young women and young men to sit at lunch counters and brave fire hoses and march through Selma and Montgomery for freedom's cause. Hope. Hope is what led me here today. With a father from Kenya, a mother from Kansas, and a story that could only happen in the United States of America. Hope is the bedrock of this nation, the belief that our destiny will not be written for us, but by us, by all those men and women who are not content to settle for the world as it is, who have the courage to remake the world as it should be. That is what we started here in Iowa, and that is the message we can now carry to New Hampshire and beyond, the same message we had when we were up and when we were down, the one that can change this country brick by brick, block by block, callous hand by callous hand, that together, ordinary people can do extraordinary things. Because we are not a collection of red states and blue states. We are the United States of America. And in this moment, in this election, we are ready to believe again. Thank you, Iowa.
He's a great oratorical master.
And here in this speech is a perfect example of using the same rhetorical tool of taking America's understanding of its exceptionalism as a place for liberty and throwing it back into the face of oppression to justify reform. He uses it starting with the American Revolution and draws a straight line through to his campaign, a black man, to run for president of the United States. And I think that that's one of the interesting things about Obama is this using the rhetoric of reform that grew up out of, in many ways, the African-American political oratory tradition. It will be very interesting to watch how and if his rhetoric changes and if it aligns with action when he is pushed back from reform movements. Does he co-opt their language? It will be terribly interesting to watch what happens when someone who has the language of reform is now the voice of power.
Kai Wright, who in March 2016 will be the features editor of our longest-running weekly magazine, The Nation. I interviewed him in January 2009, just before the first inauguration of President Obama, to talk about his then-new anthology called The African American Experience, Black History and Culture Through Speeches, Letters, Editorials, Poems, Songs, and Stories. We'll end today by listening to recent language used by President Obama in his 2016 State of the Union speech.
Whatever you may believe, whether you prefer one party or no party, whether you supported my agenda or fought as hard as you could against it, our collective futures depends on your willingness to uphold your duties as a citizen, to vote, to speak out, to stand up for others, especially the weak, especially the vulnerable, knowing that each of us is only here because somebody, somewhere, stood up for us. We need every American to stay active in our public life, and not just during election time, so that our public life reflects the goodness and the decency that I see in the American people every single day. It is not easy. Our brand of democracy is hard. But I can promise that a little over a year from now, when I no longer hold this office, I will be right there with you as a citizen, inspired by those voices of fairness and vision, of grit and good humor and kindness that have helped America travel so far. Voices that help us see ourselves not first and foremost as black or white or Asian or Latino, not as gay or straight, immigrant or native born, not Democrat or Republican, but as Americans first, bound by a common creed. Voices Dr. King believed would have the final word. Voices of unarmed truth and unconditional love. And they're out there, those voices. They don't get a lot of attention. They don't seek a lot of fanfare. But they're busy doing the work this country needs doing.
That's an excerpt from President Barack Obama's final State of the Union address. For links to this and Kai Wright's book, The African American Experience, visit newletters.org. New Letters on the Air is produced by New Letters Magazine at UMKC. Production thanks to Dennis Conroe, Kenny DeCourcy, Danette Alexander, Renita Johnson, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.